Rabbi Liebtag, it's a pleasure to be back here, and both back in Chicago and back in the shul. I've often been asked, as a teacher of Tanakh, what is the value of studying Tanakh? And then people somehow shortcut the question, they leave the T off. They say, what's the point of studying Nach? The truth is there's many answers to the question. But as I mentioned last week, there's certainly room to argue that all of the major stories and events that unfold in the rest of biblical Jewish history, Tahinu from after the death of Moshe until the rebuilding of the Mikdash, are really stories that are anchored in Sefer Bereshit. We talked about last week about Esther and Mordechai as being anchored in the story of Yosef, and some of the civil wars that take place later in Israel is being anchored in the story of Yosef and his brothers. And indeed, much of what we read in Nevi'im is sort of an unfolding of that which is in the Torah. And on a narrative level, there is perhaps no greater example of this phenomenon than the relationship of Yaakov and Esav. Yaakov and Esav have a relationship that, as we saw last week, is guided by a prophecy which is all pretty bad. Not only are there going to be two separate nations, and they're going to separate from immediately as birth, but they're going to struggle with each other, and there's always going to be subjugation of one over the other, with the delicious ambiguity, to quote the late Rabbi Bestin Zatzal, of who is going to be subjugated to whom, Rav Yavod Sa'ir. But then we saw that within the context of Sefer Bereshit, the second two components really kind of fade away. They're resolved. And the people, Yaakov and Esav, reunite. There's a pleasant reunion. And Yaakov takes charge of the relationship essentially by saying, Ani et nahala le'iti. Esav, you go ahead, I'll catch up with you. And Yaakov has no interest whatsoever in having an ongoing relationship with Esav. They've separated, but there's no more struggle. There's no more subjugation. Separate domains. And as we close the book on Sefer Bereshit, we have two ways to go. One way to go was, whew, thank God we got out of that one. But in the back of our minds, there is a nevuah. La'om mi la'om yamatz v'rav yavod sa'ir. And we have to be asking the question, is this a nevuah that has already been fulfilled, finished, and resolved? Or is it a nevuah that we have yet to see manifest itself? If you think about it, this is not a unique phenomenon. There is another very famous nevuah that we have in Sefer Bereshit, in which, again, we could argue at a certain point has been fulfilled, and again we would say, whew, because it's a very threatening and frightening nevuah. On the other hand, it's going to be echoing in the background and saying, maybe you're not there yet. And referring to the nevuah, one that we saw last week, of Brit Ben Abatarim, that we read about in this week's parasha, which, by the way, Rabbi Liebtag is parashat Lech Lecha. Just want to clear that. And in Brit Ben Atarim, Avraham is told by Hashem, Yado teda ki geri yazaracha be'eretz lo lahem v'avadum v'inu otam arba miot shana. You should know for certain that your seed will be strangers in a foreign land, and they will be oppressed for, and arba miot shana translates into a really long time. That's biblical talk for a long time. 40 is a long time, 400 is a really long time. And I will judge the nation that oppresses them, and they will leave with great wealth. And the fourth generation will then return here to Canaan, because the sin of the Amori is not complete until that point. which means I can't bring them back to inherit the land until that point comes. Seemingly, that's what it means. You, on the other hand, will die in peace. You will be buried at a good old age, meaning you will not have to see any of this. Okay. We know the words of the Nevuah. We know the import of the Nevuah. The real question is, do we know the fulfillment of the Nevuah? We are really sure that we do. In the year 2015, we are really sure that we know that that Nevuah is talking about what event in history? Yitzhak Mitzrayim. We were afflicted in a foreign land. God judged the nation that afflicted us. We left with great wealth, and we returned, and we were able to return when the sins of the locals had reached the limit, and Hashem allowed us to take the land from them. However, it's not clear that that's the only way it can be fulfilled. Rabbi Soloveitchik pointed out that Yaakov seemed to believe that he was living out Brit Ben HaMetarim. After all, what did Yaakov go through? Geri Ezar Achab Eretz Lo Lahem. Abraham, your seed will be a stranger in a foreign land. Yaakov is a stranger in a foreign land. Va'avadum ve'inu otam. He was worked and oppressed for a really long time. And I judged the nation that afflicted them. Lavan is judged by God, both in the way that the finances play out, and also in God coming to protect Yaakov from Lavan at night in Har Gilad. And Yaakov leaves with great wealth. And you move on in the Nevuah, and you could see that all of it could be pinpointed. Now, parenthetically, and this is a critical parenthesis for what we're doing tonight, and for any study of Nevuah, a prophecy is explicit, overt, and clear, or ambiguous, covert, and opaque, depending on how far down the line of history it will be fulfilled. A nevuah about something that's going to happen next week is given in very explicit terms. Look through Sefer Yirmiyahu, about Bavel, about Nebuchadnezzar, named. But a nevuah about the end of days is by definition given in vague terms. And it can play out in many different ways. Look at the very many vague terms used by Yaakov on his deathbed about what's going to happen to his children. And every mefaresh has a different take on understanding what those nevuot mean. Because they're vague. The terms are vague. Explicit countries and explicit names and explicit dates and explicit events are not mentioned there. And there are a lot of ways that that nevuah can be fulfilled. And the same is true about Brit Ben HaTarim. And coming back here, the same is certainly true about the prophecy given to Rivka, which really informs this entire series. Shnei goyim bevitnechu, shnei le'umim mimeyachi paredu la'om milom yamatz, v'rav yavod sayir. Those four famous terms. You have two nations in your womb, two ethnicities that will separate at birth, one group will struggle with the other, and one will subjugate the other. Unclear who is whom. And so as we read through Sefer Bereishit, we think, perhaps we dodged a bullet. Perhaps the men themselves, Yaakov and Esav, were able to overcome the burden of the second half of that prophecy and close the circle. But in the back of our mind, just like Brit Ben HaTarim, there's something ringing and saying, maybe we're not out of the woods yet. So let's see what happens with the relationship between Yaakov and Esav throughout the rest of biblical history. Now, to do this properly, to be honest, is more than one shiur. So we will hit particular highlights. And we are going to take a necessary digression, which is not a digression, to deal with the thorniest component of the relationship between Yaakov and Esav. Well, let's take a look. In your sources, the first source is a source that requires us to think a little bit about the narrative in Tanakh, and specifically the narrative in early Tanakh. Vayomer Esav el Yaakov, halaiteni na min ha'adom ha'adom hazeh. Famous scene, Esav comes from the hunt, and Yaakov is making food, and Esav says, hey, give me some of that red stuff. Ki ayef anochi. Ayef, by the way, in Tanakh, means hungry, perhaps thirsty. Take a look, for instance, in Shoftim Zion. Alkein karashmo Edom. What does that mean? Alkein karashmo Edom. Just translate. What does that phrase mean? Okay, so now, when is that phrase happening? When is that phrase happening? So immediately on the spot, he eats it, and Yaakov says, hey, Red, how's it going? That might work. Let's look at the next source. In Bereishit Lamed Vav, a very difficult parak. A difficult parak because it gives a detailed list of Esau's family, to which we have a two-word response, which is, who cares? I can tell you it's a Balkri, it's a very difficult parak. Because it's hard to get inspired about Ohali Vama and her kids. There's one name in there that we particularly don't want to hear. But notice how the Toldot of Esav are introduced. Ve'ele Toldot Esav hu Edom. Esav, the one known as Edom, these are his Toldot. And further on, we hear, a little bit later in the parak, Vayikach Esav et nashav et manav et notav et kol nafshot beito, ve'nigneo v'kol behemto v'kol kinyano asher achash be'eretz Kanan, which, by the way, is almost a cut and paste job from the beginning of this week's parasha, Vayikach Avram et Sarai Ishto, ve'et Lot ben Achiv, ve'et Kol Rechusham asher achashu, ve'et Hanefesh asher asu v'charan. By the way, it makes us very uncomfortable to see Esav described in Abrahamic terms. We don't like that. But it's there. And what does he do? Vayelech al eretz mnei Yaakov achiv. He left the land to make room for Yaakov. Again, a very positive thing to read about Esav. That he concedes that the land belongs to Yaakov and he moves somewhere else. And where he moves to is no great metziah. Keyar rechusham rav mishevet yachdav, which reminds us of whose relationship? Avraham and Lot, again in this week's parsha. Again, stories repeating in Tanakh. But critically here, unlike Lot, who has to sort of get Avram to initiate the move, Esav on his own says, you know what? We have too much stuff. Yaakov owns the land. I'm bugging out. Vayeshev Esav Mehar Seir Esav Hu Edom. Now why this repetition, Esav Hu Edom? Well, the answer is that there is a nation that resides as one of our neighbors in southwest Jordan. That nation is known as Edom. And the way that Bereshit describes it, and not just Bereshit, we're going to see it in Bamidbar, we will see it in Devarim, and we will see it all the way at the end of Tanakh, all tonight. This land of Edom, this country of Edom, a neighbor of ours, was founded by Esav and his children, and is populated by the families of Esav. And now you got to go back and ask the question about the porridge. Alkein karashmo Edom. What does that mean? Does that mean that the guy Esav was called Red because he came home and said, give me some of that red stuff? If you think about it, by the way, we don't need him to say that to call him Red. He is Red. He's Admoni. Or does it mean that later in history we refer to the nation that he founds as Edom and we associate it with that first story about the porridge? Which then leads us to ask the following question. When is that pasuk happening, Esav hu Edom? Both in Bereshit Chafei and in Bereshit Lamed Vav, in the two first sources. So I'm going to suggest something that at first glance, I'll ask you to bear with me for a couple minutes. At first listen, sounds a bit heretical. But if you think about it for a moment, you will see that it is nothing of the sort, and it's the derech of the Rishonim. When was the Torah written? Moshe Rabbeinu, sometime during his life, we'll leave it Parav there to avoid the issue of Chatuma Nitna, Megillah, Megillah Nitna. Somewhere between Har Sinai and Avot Moab, the Torah was written. Okay. Does the Torah record events that happened before that? Sure, all the way from Bereishit until Yetziat Mitzrayim. But when are those events dictated by HaKadosh Baruch Hu to Moshe to write down? Later on. And so HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Moshe, this is how I want you to write it. This is the way I want you to phrase it. By the way, when Paro says, Lo Yadati Et Hashem, I don't know who Hashem is. Are those the words Paro used? I promise you they're not. He spoke Egyptian. So what happens? Hashem tells Moshe, this is how I want you to write it. This is the way I want you to translate it or present it. But you can see that the Torah itself is edited by Moshe. And that's the part that sounds a little off, but think about it. The story of the man. The man. When does it happen? When does the story of the man happen? It's at the end of middle of Parsha Peshalach. Happens in the desert between which two major events? Create Yam Suf, Tziyat Mitzrayim, and Matan Torah, right? The man starts, the whole story of the man happens before we get the Torah. At the end of the story of the man, what does it say? HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe, tell Aharon to put a vial of the man Lifnei Hashem. Can you please tell me what Lifnei Hashem means? What does that mean before God? And so the next pasuk says, "Vayanechei Aharon lifnei haidut lemishmeret." Aharon places it in front of the luchot habrit, in front of the edut. I'm sorry, the luchot what? How do you have luchot habrit before Matan Torah? How do you have an Aharon before Matan Torah? You don't have Mishkan before Matan Torah. None of it exists. But if that weren't difficult enough, what does the next pasuk say? "Uvnei Yisrael achlu ataman arba'im shana." For how long did Bnei Yisrael eat man? 40 years. I'm sorry, was that the plan when we left Mitzrayim to wander for 40 years? How long were we supposed to be in the Midbar? A few months, maybe. Right? And then go right in. The clear assumption in Shemot Yud Bet is by next Pesach we'll be in Israel. So how does the Pasuk say, Bnei Israel ate them on for 40 years? So as the Rishonim all agree, that part, that pasuk is written by Moshe Rabbeinu at the end of the 40 years. The Torah itself has to be edited to reflect the reality. So is it possible that Esav Hu'edom is not a Bereishit pasuk, but a Bamidbar pasuk? By the time Bnei Israel leave Mitzrayim and they're wandering around and they have to circle a nation called Edom, and we'll find out why they have to circle them, now we make an association and say, aha, you know who Edom is? That is your brother, Esav. And we connect it and associate it with, give me some red stuff. Esav hu Edom. Here is the necessary digression. In that very bizarre passage, in Bereishit Lamed Vav, which goes through the lineage of Esav, we hear, among others, about Esav's firstborn son Eliphaz, who became very famous in the world of Midrash. This Eliphaz had a concubine named Timnah. Vatelel Eliphaz et Amalek. Now you can start making noise. And she gave birth with Eliphaz to a child named Amalek, and that's who that family is. What do we know about this particular Amalek? Well, we know that later on Amalek has become a clan, meaning this fellow Amalek has a family, becomes the head of a clan, and the clan is known as the Amalek clan. Later on in history, there are several Amalek clans, and we'll talk about that in a moment. The Amalek clan, or one of them, attacks Bnei Israel in the desert from the rear. And we go to war against them. What's the result of that war, by the way? What's the outcome of that war? Who won? Nobody won. If we won, then there's no more lake. If they won, well, let's not go there.
Well, a win doesn't mean a total eradication.
Good. So we'd call it a draw. Essentially a draw. Yeshua beats them off, but doesn't beat them up. What does HaKadosh Baruch Hu say? Take a look at source 4. Vayomer Adonai Moshe, K'tov zot zikaron ba'sefer, v'sim ba'oznei Yehoshua. Yehoshua, who has already made his first appearance here as the general, write this down, tell Yehoshua, K'imacho emcha et zecher Amalek mitachat ha'shamayim. I will wipe out Amalek from under the heavens. Amalek has become the lightning rod for God's anger. In the next pasuk, which I didn't have room for here, there is a conundrum brought in. Because what does HaKadosh Baruch Hu say? I have a perennial war against Amalek. Midor dor. Time out. How do you have a perennial war against somebody you're going to wipe out? If HaKadosh Baruch Hu promises he's going to wipe them out, he's good for that. Which means, at some point, Amalek's going to be gone. If Amalek's going to be gone, how do you have an eternal war against them? They're not here. And this is part of the puzzle of understanding the larger question tonight, which is, what happens to Yaakov and Esav in the rest of Tanakh? So for a moment, let's go off of the text that we have in front of us. What happens with this Amalek later on in history? Something very curious. Because according to the mitzvah given to us in Sefer Shmot and repeated in a slightly varied version in Sefer Dvarim, we are supposed to always remember Amalek. We are obligated to wipe them out. Which if you think about the inherent conundrum in that, you have to scream so you don't hear Amon's name, but you have to hear Amon's name to be Yotze. Think about that. In effect, what really happens with Amalek later on in history? Amalek shows up in Sefer Shoftim several times. Nobody pays much attention to them, except for the fact that they're one of the bullies beating up on us, so we try to overthrow them. Gidon. Amalek shows up in Sefer Shmuel. For the first time, we hear that a king is told to go to war against Amalek. Shaul. When Shaul finally brings the king of Amalek to Shmuel for the proper trophy ritual killing that we read about throughout Yehoshua and Shoftim, what does Shmuel say to him? Does Shmuel say to him, you are the descendant of terrible people and that's why I'm going to kill you? Is that what he says? No. What do he says? Kasher shikla nashim chabecha kein tishkal minashim imecha. As you made women childless because you killed their sons, your mother will become the most childless. Because how do you become the most childless? Okay, it's poetry. Why is Agag being killed? Not because he's the descendant of, but because he's a terrible guy. He is a terrible person who's done terrible things. And if you take a look at the rest of Sefer Shmuel, you will see that that particular group of Amalek was not all of Amalek. It was one group. And nobody paid any attention to the other guys. Take a look at Shmuel Aleph Perek Lamed. David and his men leave their town near Aza to go north. The Amaleki raiders come and take all of the women and children and animals from their town. So David chases after them. Read it, it's right there in Shmuel Aleph, Perek Lamed. David chases them. Why does he chase them? Because they're Amalek and there's a mitzvah to kill them? No, because they took our families. And David beats up on them and kills a bunch of them, and a bunch of them get away, and David does not chase them. Very strange. But it gets stranger when you take a look at Source 5. Source 5, which is at the very end of the fourth chapter of Divrei Hayamim. Divrei Hayamim, as you may know, at the beginning, goes through lineages of each of the tribes. Sort of what happened to them in the land. And the end of Perek Dalet is devoted to a tribe that's among the least significant tribes once we've settled into the land, and that's the tribe of Shimon. Because Shimon doesn't really do much. But in Divrei Hayamim, they do something. And they end up moving, interestingly, to the land of Edom. and they go to war. And during the times of Chizkiyahu HaMelech, the Hainu, around 700 BCE, look what the Pasuk says. Vayaku et she'irita pleita la'amalek. They destroyed the last remnants of Amalek. What does that tell you? From that point on, there's nobody alive named Amalek. No genealogical descendant of Amalek left alive in the world. The last one's been wiped out. You got to ask the question, so how do we have a mitzvah of Zachor? And how do we have a mitzvah of Timcha? You have to remember and you have to wipe out and they're not around anymore. How do you do that? Very strange. Did I get one? Somebody said, what?
Spiritual descendants.
Oh, very good. So Soloveitchik suggested, based on his father's diuk in the Rambam, that Amalek represents not a genealogy, but an ideology. And those people who appropriate the ideology of Amalek then become subject to the mitzvah of both Zachor and perhaps Machotimcha. The Rav was willing to take it as far as Zachor in Kol Dodi Dofek, and the Rav maintained that participating in a commemoration of the Shoah is a fulfillment of the mitzvah of Zechirat Maaseh Amalek. Even though it would be very difficult to claim that any of the Teutons, who are the, perhaps, ancestors of the Nazis, Yimach Shemam, were related in any way to Amalek, who, by the way, if you remember, Amalek is family. It's probably the most painful thing. And that will play a role in the larger picture of Edom that we're going to see now. But we've seen so far, two little pieces, is there is a nevuah that's ringing in our heads from Sefer Bereishit that gives us a little malaise, a little loss of sleep. Maybe this nevuah has not been fulfilled yet, and maybe there is yet going to be conflict with Esav. Yaakov is dead, Esav is dead, and yet we are Yaakov. And if we identify who is Esav, let's see what plays out. The second piece of the puzzle is that perhaps the lightning rod, the focal point, the most extreme version of what we identify in Esav is Esav's grandson Amalek and what happens with him. But interestingly enough, we never actually act on it, but we talk about it a lot. Which may be the key to understanding what happens here. Okay, take a look at source 6. Source 6, I want to look at much more for the wording than anything else. I'm going to read the beginning of source 6 and tell me what echoes for you from Sefer Bereishit. Vayishlach Moshe malachim mikadesh ha-melech Edom. Ko amar achicha Yisrael. Ata yadat et kol atla Hashem etzadnu. Moshe sends Malachim to the king of Edom and says, you know all of the travails that we have been through. Going to Egypt, getting out of Egypt, etc., going through the desert. What does this sound like? What parsha is coming up in about 5 weeks? With the starts of the same first word? Vayishlach. By the way, how does that first line of Vayishlach go? Vayishlach, Ziba Mitzvah. So, Vayishlach. Yaakov, Malachim, El, Esav Achiv, right? Im Lavan Garti. In other words, it's exactly this. The leader sends Malachim, messengers, to Esav, to the king of Edom, and says, you know all the terrible things I've been through, and now I'm coming here. At that point, the narrative changes a little bit. But why does Moshe use those words? Or more critically, why does HaKadosh Baruch Hu tell Moshe to write those words in Sefer Bamidbar? HaKadosh Baruch Hu is telling us, Edom is Esav, but Israel is Yaakov. And baby, that prophecy is not done yet. We're not finished. And therefore HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells, it doesn't matter whether Moshe used those words. He says, this is the way I want you to represent it, as an echo from the meeting between Yaakov and Esav. When we get to the beginning of Sefer Dvarim, we see that the relationship with Esav is one very much of safe distance. Safe distance. Ata'am Tzav Lemor, Source 7. Atem Ovrim Bigvul Achechem B'nei Esav Ayoshvim Seir. We're coming to Edom, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, these are B'nei Esav. This is where they live. V'yiru Mikem Nishmartem Me'od. They will be afraid of you, but you better be careful. Al Titkaruvam. Do not provoke them, meaning provoke them to war. By the way, Am Yisrael through the Midbar is marching as an army. Ki lo etein lachem miartzam. You do not get to inherit their land. Ad midrach kafragel, even to walk through. Ki Yerushal lo esav natati tarsayir. I, God says, I have given this as an inheritance to Esav. Esav is in the family. Esav is not totally out. Esav is not Yishmael who's been rejected. Esav is in, and he's got land, and I've given it to him, and I'm not letting you take that land from him. Maybe ever, maybe in the meantime. And then later in Devarim, we read something that's just fascinating. Whereas the people of Ammon and Moab are permanently distanced from ever marrying into our people, Source 8, Lo tita'ev Adomi ki achichahu. You may not reject an Adomi, he's your brother. Lo tita'ev Mitzri ki ger ayita b'artzo. And likewise, you shall not reject, push away an Egyptian because you were a stranger in his land. And therefore, their third generation may marry in, which halachically means if somebody from either Edom and or Mitzrayim, which neither of which exist anymore, was to convert and was to marry another Edomi. Well, Edomia, or Edomit. I come from L.A., I've got to be careful about these things. The third generation, their grandchildren, could marry into Am Yisrael. Give them a waiting period, but they can marry in. So how are we supposed to relate to Esav? They have their land. You're not allowed to mess with them. You got to circle around them. If they show a real intent to join the nation, you have to honor that and allow them to marry in, third generation. And yet in the back, there's Rav Yavod Sa'ir ringing, which may itself be a very powerful lesson in morality. Is that even though we may have a larger vision of what may be happening, on the ground we have to deal with the reality we have. Right now we've got Esav behaving like a brother, have to treat him like a brother. But at arm's length, because we know what the nevuah is. But you can't fully push him away because right now he's behaving like a brother. And that's Chazal's famous comment on when Yaakov and Esav reunite and Esav embraces him. At the time that he acts like a brother, you've got to treat him like a brother. So much for the rest of Torah, and by all means, that's not so much for the rest of Torah, but there's much we're able to cover in the rest of Psukim in Chumash that deal with Esav and Edom. Esav and Edom are dealt with very little through Sefer Shmuel. Not at all, really, in Yehoshua and Shoftim, and Shmuel, small mention. Perek Chet and Shmuel Bet, where it talks about David's expanding his kingdom. In Sefer Melachim, Edom shows up quite a bit. Because Sefer Melachim covers several hundred years of political and military history, and Edom, from time to time, plays a role in that military history. The reality is that Edom, as a special case, as somebody would look back and say, aha, this is that Esav from Breshit that spawned Amalek, only shows up at the end of Bayit Rishon. And we'll see why. Remember what we said about Brit Ben HaMetarim? Only after it comes true do we look back and say, aha, now I get what it was referring to. It was referring to Mitzrayim. The whole time it could have been referring to something else. I'll give you a small other example of that. When Yaakov on his deathbed says to Yehuda, Lo yasur shevet mi Yehuda, the scepter shall not depart from Yehuda. If you're a member of Shevet Yehuda, what do you think that means? That means that when there's finally a king, the king's going to come from Yehuda. And that's what you tell your kids around the campfire. Hey, one of you guys might be the first king. Cool. What do you do when the Navi appoints somebody from Shevet Binyamin as the first king? What do you do? The Navi was wrong? Yaakov was wrong? Or I was wrong? Maybe Lo Yasur Shevet Yehuda means something else. Maybe it means, like the Ramban says, that once a king from Yehuda is appointed, then it'll never leave. Or it might mean something else. That's how it is with Nevuot. So we do not know how they're going to play out, and only in retrospect can we look back and say, maybe that was the fulfillment. Unless we have a Navi there to confirm that it is. Which is why passage 9 is strange. It's also somewhat upsetting. Amos. This is around the year of 750 BCE. Amos is an Avi from Tekoa. I think we all know where Tekoa is. And Amos comes and gives Nevuah against the north, against Shomron. And his opening two chapters, opening chapter and a half, are delightful and scary. On a poetic level, they're delightful. On a descriptive level, they're scary and upsetting. They all follow the pattern. Ko amar Adonai, ashlosha pishei damesek v'al ba'alu ashivenu. For the three sins of this nation, they'll be punished, and for the fourth one, I won't let them go. And then he lists a particular sin, whether it's the fourth one or the one that broke the straw that broke the camel's back, or the first one, we don't know. And he lists Damascus, that's Syria, we've heard of them. Aza, we've heard of them too. Sor, Lebanon. Ammon, Moab, Edom. Basically, there's an X being created, a box. Finally, Yehuda, and then Israel. Israel's boxed in. In his Nevuah against Edom, he says the following. And Hashem is going to punish each one of these nations for the terrible things they've done. What is the terrible sin of Edom? Al rodfo b'cherev achiv. He chased his brother with the sword. Who's his brother? That's us. That's us. So at some point during Bayit Rishon history, Edom attacked Israel. And that's considered to be a terrible sin. It gets worse. V'shichet rachamav. What is shichet rachamav? How did the translation come out on the other side there? Shichet rachamav. He what? He cast off all of his pity. Interesting. In the Septuagint, in the Greek translation of the Tanakh, the earliest translation we have, the word is not rachamav, but it's rather read as rechamav, meaning the womb. He destroyed the wombs, which means that Edom attacked pregnant women and did terrible things to them. Something we read about earlier on with Damascus. Terrible, terrible description. And it gets worse. Vayitrof la'ad apo. He kept his anger alive forever. Ve'evrato shemara netzach. And his wrath, he held on forever. Suddenly, after a few hundred years of Edom being no longer a special case, being a neighbor, with whom sometimes we get along, sometimes we don't get along, in regular military history. Suddenly, in the middle of it, the issue of brotherhood comes up again. And the issue of a long memory of Esav still being angry and holding on to that anger and acting out on that anger suddenly comes up again, out of nowhere. And one has to look at this and say, what is Amos talking about? And we have no idea. And if we're living in the 8th century BCE and we hear the man from Tekoa, the former cowboy from Tekoa, as by his own admission, who is now a prophet, kind of like, what's he talking about? Stick around, Chevra. Stick around for 150 years. You'll find out. The most famous book of Tanakh that deals with Esav is the shortest book in Tanakh. It's a great answer to a trivia quiz. What's the shortest book in Tanakh? Book of Ovadia. How big is it? One chapter. My students who at the beginning of their course with me learn how to cite psukim in Tanakh properly get surprised when I put Ovadia Chaf Aleph. I said, Chaf Aleph what? I said, that's it. There's no prakim, it's just Perek Aleph. Said, that's it, just cite the pasuk. 21 psukim, that's the whole thing. And the entire nevuah of Ovadia is against Edom. And many, if not most, within our camp, will agree that the book of Ovadia was composed around the time of the destruction. Why? So let's get perhaps a more explicit mention. Parentheses here, but it's too much fun to ignore. Who wrote Sefer Tehillim? What? Excellent, thank you. Chazal disagree with you. Chazal maintained that Tehillim is an anthology of tefillot said by all sorts of people. Adam HaRishon, Moshe Rabbeinu, Avram Avinu, Malki Tzedek. And there are two versions in Chazal. In one version in Chazal, David is the last contributor and the anthologizer, the organizer. In the other version in Chazal, in Midrash Shir Hashirim, Midrash Kohelet, Ezra is the final contributor. And there are several Rishonim that picked up on this Midrash in explaining perhaps the most difficult parak in Tehillim to explain if we maintain that David wrote all of Tehillim. And that is Al Naharot Bavel. Al Naharot Bavel, Sham Yashamnu Gam Bachinu Bezochreinu at Zion. It's very difficult to put into David's mouth. But regardless, it is clearly about the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash and the destruction of Yerushalayim. And towards the end of it, you hear a phrase that to our ears has a whole different meaning, a 180-degree different meaning. Zachor Adonai Livnei Edom et Yom Yerushalayim. To us, Yom Yerushalayim is a picture of four paratroopers in front of the Kotel. Yom Yerushalayim is Naomi Shemer. Yom Yerushalayim is Hallel, with or without a bracha. Take your pick. Yom Yerushalayim in Tanakh is the day of the destruction of Yerushalayim. And what does the Mishorer, the author, say to Hashem? Remember Hashem against Edom at Yom Yerushalayim. Because what did the people of Edom say on that day? Ha'omrim aru aru ad ha'yisod ba. By the way, who destroyed the Beit HaMikdash? Who destroyed Yerushalayim? Bavel. And suddenly we hear that the people of Edom, who parenthetically, during the period of the fall of the kingdom of Yehuda, had started moving into Drom Har Chevron, into the area of the North Negev, and taking some of that territory, they came to Yerushalayim, and as the Bavlim were destroying Yerushalayim, they egged them on, and they said, Aru, Aru, strip her naked all the way to the foundation. And in Eicha, you read the same thing, in Perek Dalet. In Perek Dalet, where the author finally gets angry and expresses his anger and says, Sisi v'simchi bat Edom, yoshevet beretz utz. Edom, you should be very happy. Gam alayich tavor kos tishkari v'titari. You're going to also drink a cup of punishment. Rejoice now, but your punishment's coming. What happened? And this changes everything about how we look at Edom. And it changes everything about how we then look back at the man Esav. Somehow, when it came to the destruction of Yehuda, the destruction of Yerushalayim, the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, the Edomim got in there like, and I won't say Lahavdil because it's very much the same thing, like the Ukrainians, and like the Lithuanians, and like the Letts, and like the Poles, and all the other people who were all too willing to do the extra dirty work of the Nazis, Yimach Shemam. But why? Why? Why is Edom so hell-bent on seeing our destruction and humiliation? And I think the answer sits in that pasuk in Amos. That pasuk that again sat there for 200 years, I'll be saying, what's that about? What do you mean? That there's something in Esav, something in Esav's family, that holds on to that anger forever, that holds on to the sense of indignation, of victimization, forever, and deliberately stirs it up. And when suddenly, hundreds of years later, Yehuda, for the first time in the history of the world, Yehuda is crumbling, that's when Edom gets in and says, Aru, Aru, Arei Sodba. What is the job of a Navi? The job of a Navi is very simple. Tell the people what God says you should tell the people. Pretty straightforward. But what does God tell the Navi to tell the people? Sometimes he says, tell the people that they're doing wrong. And if they don't get their act together, bad things will happen. And you have to do tshuva. And here's what you got to do. You got to stop mistreating the disenfranchised. You've got to cut out the Avodah Zarah. You got to start respecting Shabbat. Those are the three main tropes, of course, through the Nevi'im. And then sometimes the Navi comes along to say, Kindelach, it's okay. HaKadosh Baruch Hu loves you. Nachamu, Nachamu Ami. When does the Navi scream? When the people are laughing. When does the Navi comfort? When the people are weeping. Yeshayahu does not say, Nachamu, Nachamu Ami, to the women of Yerushalayim who are walking there in their high heels, as described in Yeshayahu Bet. He says it to the people who are fallen after the destruction. Yirmiyahu does not say, Kol beraman nishma v'shavu vanim ligvulam, to the people in Yerushalayim who are still holding on to their Hebrew slaves. He says it to the people who are being taken in chains off to exile in Bavel. They're weeping and he comforts. The Mikdash was destroyed. Yerushalayim was destroyed. Yehuda was destroyed. And half a century later, the destroyer was destroyed, a new empire arose, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu used that new empire to revive us. And the emperor of this Persian-Median coalition issued an edict allowing us to go back and rebuild, and even gave us money and animals and gold and silver to go and rebuild. And we went back in a pathetic fashion. 42,000 out of perhaps a million went back and rebuilt. And we're sitting there in an impoverished community with a very insignificant building relative to the one that they had heard about or had seen, the original Beit HaMikdash. And they felt as if God had abandoned them. Take a look at the bottom passage. Malachi, the last of the Nevi'im, around the year 465 BCE. Masad v'Adonai Yisrael b'yad Malachi. Ahavti etchem amar Adonai. So what's the job of the Navi? When the people are crying? To console them. Hashem says, this is a particular form of nevuah called dialogic nevuah, where the Navi is presenting a dialogue that's happening between two parties. Parties being Bnei Yisrael and Hashem. Hashem says, I love you. Va'amartem b'me'a havtanu. And your response to Hashem is, what do you mean you love us? What have you done for us lately, or at all? And what's Hashem's answer? Halo ach Esav li Yaakov ne'um Adonai v'ahavet Yaakov. Is not Esav a brother of Yaakov? And look how I favored Yaakov. Ve'et Esav saneti, I disfavored Esav. Vasim et harav shmamav et nachvato letanot midbar. His land is a wasteland. It's where jackals scream. And on and on. In what must be a most curious turn, at the time of our greatest despondence, feeling that Hashem has abandoned us, HaKadosh Baruch Hu points not to the history of Yetziat Mitzrayim, not to the history of Matan Torah, not to the history of the wars of Yoshua, but to much earlier in our history. And he says, of course I love you. Look at Yaakov, look at Esav, and look what I gave Yaakov. I gave Yaakov this beautiful land. Look at Esav's land. What's going on? In what becomes a historic 180, Esav at the time of the destruction is presented as a vile opportunist who steps in the crease of the moment and allows his anger to find expression. Aru, aru, ada yisod ba. Strip Yerushalayim down all the way to the foundation. But what happens soon afterwards? HaKadosh Baruch Hu brings us back. Edom disappears. Perhaps briefly to their jackal-infested land in southwest Jordan, and then they disappear. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu turns to Bnei Yisrael and says, you see that I love you. That love is not expressed in constantly being on a high wave. That love is expressed with me being with you all the time. Imon ochi v'tzara, I'm with you when things are difficult. But I'm still with you. And I'm with you now when you see that the enemy has fallen. I have never abandoned you. And when you thought that things were so dark, I was still there. And now look at Esav, at Edom, who a few years ago was cackling in the fires of the Mikdash. Aru, aru, adai sodba. Sisi v'simchi. And now look what's happened to Edom. My love for you, Yaakov, and for my love for you, Bnei Yaakov, is eternal. But we have to watch it go through all the vicissitudes of all the cycles of history until we get to the end of this history in order to see it. And lest we think that Malachi is the end of the road, Malachi is not the end of the road. For that we have next week. Because what Chazal do in the Midrashim, which is what we're going to focus on next week, the Midrashim that inform our response to the destruction of Yerushalayim in the year 70, are built upon the notion that what happened in the year 586 BCE, what Eicha is about, is repeated, just much worse. And that's why the Midrashim in Eicha all pick up on the Psukim in Eicha and translate them as being about the destruction of Yerushalayim in the year 70 by the nation known as Rome. And next week we're going to find out why, perhaps we'll find out, we'll explore why the nation that destroys the Mikdash the second time is known by Chazal as Edom. And how this sense of built-in history, going back to the Nevuah given to Rivka, is something that is an eternal piece of the fabric of our nation and our nation's relations with others. And even though the Esav the man and Edom the nation may no longer be, Esav the man and Edom the nation are here forever. And how we contend with them is something that we need to have wisdom for, and hopefully next week we'll get a little bit more enlightenment. Mirtz Hashem, we will continue to learn Torah together, Lishma. The Torah that we learn should hopefully be a source also of protection for Achenu and Achiyotenu in Eretz Yisrael who are under siege of Bnei Adom. And of course, should be a chizuk for Refuah Shleima for Yisrael Yehuda, Bendita Sarah.